Hey guys, it's Candace.
And it's Elena.
And you're listening to Cousins on Crime. I'm not in the mood to be doing that. I don't know why I'm hyping. I think because I'm not in the mood, I'm trying to like hype myself up. Because.
Yeah, maybe we should do our own hype music before we start recording.
Yeah. Hmm. Yes, I like it. And then we just don't have to share that with people.
Right. Or maybe that could be part of our Patreon.
People are hitting the fast forward, the 30 seconds. Is it 30 seconds forward, 15 seconds back?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, right. Now those who didn't know that you could do that are now doing that. Well, today's case is a bit of a doozy.
It's always got a doozy.
It's a doozy. And I feel like it's going to spark a lot of conversation.
Okay.
And so let's just go for it.
Okay.
I remember being a little kid and watching a show on this case because my mother, Brenda, watched crime shows in my presence as I grew up, which Daniel will not let me do in front of my kids.
Yeah.
Which is like, you got to start them young. No, you don't. But anyways, I grew up watching crime shows with my mom. Okay. And here I am. Here true crime podcasting. Are. But I remember seeing this as a young kid, and it happened before I was born, but they were like revisiting it because it was unsolved. And then I came across it a couple weeks ago and I was like,
I've seen
oh
this.
My gosh, I remember that. So this is technically still an unsolved case, still open, but the police involved in the original investigation believe they know who the killer is.
Oh.
There are multiple victims in this case. One child, so just be aware.
Okay.
Before we get into the death part, let's go back to a simpler time, 1982.
Oh.
We were not even a twinkle in our parents' eye yet. My mom had just graduated high school. E.T. was in the theaters.
Oh.
And Hasbro had just launched the G.I. Joe action figure line.
Oh, how cool.
Right? So what a time to be alive.
All right. Things were happening.
I've now officially lost a bunch of people. I know. Because they're like, E.T., what is G.I. Joe? The early 80s were a vibe. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So a straight coolness. And in Chicago, art galleries were blossoming all over the city, accompanied by performing art theaters. And the Bears and the Bulls were a powerhouse in the professional sports. The Bears. And actually, fun fact, when I was growing up as a kid, I loved the Chicago Bulls. They were like Michael Jordan.
Oh, yeah.
Was dough on his thing. Uh-huh. He actually didn't join the Bulls until a couple years after this happened.
You know that?
I've got to pause for a second because the fact that I pulled that from a file that had been buried in my mind.
Right. I don't.
I have to tell Daniel about this because when he tries to tell me about sports, I'm like shutting it down.
Right.
I'm like, please do not overwrite important information in my brain. But
yeah, there if y'all could see my face,
Elena is like, shocked to her very core.
I'm over here like, huh?
She's like, what?
You know that?
A sports statistic? Yeah, so there's that. But for all the wonderful things going on back then, there were safeguards that we rely on today that didn't exist back in 1982.
Oh.
There were no tamper seals on medicines or food.
Oh.
You could literally just go into the grocery store and stick your nasty finger in a thing of peanut butter and...
No way.
Yeah. There was no seals. It wasn't until after a string of deaths on one fateful day that safety seals were put in place for medicines and foods.
Oh.
It was just after 6 a.m. on September 29th, 1982, and 12-year-old Mary Kellerman from Elk Grove Village complained to her parents that she wasn't feeling well. She had a sore throat and a runny nose, and she had convinced her dad that she wasn't going to make it through the school day, feeling so rotten.
Yeah.
Mary was an only child, so she had daddy wrapped around her little finger. It wasn't just that. She really was a good kid. So he knew, like, she must really not feel.
I remember asking my dad a few times, like, I would go to him and ask to stay home. Because
you knew
home.
It was going
to
work
knew he was going to say, okay, baby, you can stay home. But he was like, just try to go to school. Aww. I'm like, okay.
She loved spending time with her parents. She loved to cook with her mom. She played Atari with her dad. She babysat to earn money. And one of her friends described her as just a really warm person that you just wanted to be around.
Aww.
She had a pony.
Oh, fun.
And so she loved playing with her pony, and she loved making pottery. She just sounds like a cool girl, you know, all around. Her father said, okay, you know, go take something and go lay down to rest. So Mary grabbed a bottle of Tylenol that her mother had purchased the night before and took one extra strength capsule. And not a full minute later, Mary's dad heard coughing and a big thud.
What?
Mary was laying on the cold bathroom floor, struggling to breathe.
No.
Her eyes were fixed into space.
What?
Paramedics arrived promptly and quickly realized they could not help her there. Mary was in full cardiac arrest.
Oh my gosh.
So they rushed her to the nearby Alexian Brothers Medical Center, but there was nothing doctors could do for her either.
No.
They even installed a pacemaker to try and bring her heartbeat back, but that wasn't effective.
Oh.
And in what seemed like the blink of an eye, Mary was dead.
Wow. Oh my gosh.
Later that morning, Adam Janus, a Polish immigrant, was running errands with his family. He had left Poland in 1963 when his dad refused to join the Communist Party. And now, as an adult himself, Adam was working for the U.S. Postal Service, providing a great life for his own family. Adam was a hard worker who had been promoted to supervisor just a couple years after starting his job there and loved to restore grandfather clocks in his spare time.
Oh, that's fun.
Yeah. He lived with his wife and two children in a lovely home on a quiet street in the Chicago suburb of Arlington Heights. And it truly was the American dream.
Yeah.
It was late morning, and Adam picked up his 4-year-old daughter from the Catholic preschool she attended near their home. And like any good man, you know, he stopped by the Jewel grocery store on his way home to grab some things that his wife asked for him to pick up.
Aww.
His daughter, Kasia, told NBC 15 News she remembers that particular errand quite well. Because she was fascinated by all the travel size items.
Oh.
And I totally like remember being a kid and being like, how cute is this little deodorant?
I
mean, I didn't even use deodorant as a child, but she remembers looking at all the little things and she was like, oh, they're little like me. But her dad didn't want to buy any of that. Instead, he bought, you know, some boring stuff, and he bought some Tylenol. When she was like, no, I don't want that boring white bottle. I want this little bottle of scope. So shortly after arriving home, Adam unloaded the shopping, took 2 Tylenol for the headache he had, and he instantly felt worse.
Oh.
He came out of the bathroom clutching his chest, and his wife met him in the hallway, and he said to her, something's not right. So she followed him in the bedroom.
Oh, no.
Where he laid down and he began breathing very shallow and started staring off into space.
No way.
She ran outside because she had remembered that 2 of her neighbors were out there talking, and one of which was a nurse. So she ran out there to get the women and bring them inside. She's like, please help. The nurse performed CPR while the other called an ambulance. And despite the neighbors and the paramedics' quick actions in trying to resuscitate Adam and rushing him to the hospital that was so close to his home, it just wasn't enough to save the 27-year-old husband and father. Adam was pronounced dead at 3:35 p.m. Now, initially, his family thought this was a heart attack or something.
27 years old.
Yeah. Yeah. And he had actually not been feeling well the day before. Like, he was complaining of, like, I don't know, his chest, and just, he just kind of felt weird. So they were like, wow, he just had a heart attack out of nowhere. Mm. They really weren't sure, though. And truth be told, the doctors weren't really sure either what happened. Even the moments after following his death, they were like, you know, and they were like, we'll send off toxicology, but that's going to take a while to get some answers. Now, hours after Adam was rushed to the hospital, loved ones started gathering at his quaint home that he shared with his little family to comfort each other. And, you know, and over this sudden gut-wrenching loss.
Right.
Adam's little brother, Stanley, and his wife, Teresa, arrived to offer their support for Adam's wife and children. I mean, they were like, if you need anything. Mm-hmm. And Adam's wife was also named Teresa, so I'll try not to confuse you guys. But the newlyweds, Stanley and Teresa, were in complete shock, you know, that someone so young and full of life could just be gone in an instant.
Yeah.
They were undoubtedly grief-stricken and began to feel overwhelmed with confusion and of the unanswered questions and, like, the physiological implications of sadness and grief. You know, it just makes you feel, you know, when you're so upset that you just feel sick.
Oh yeah.
So that was them. They were feeling it. And Stanley had already been feeling back pain that day, so he reached for the bottle of Tylenol in Adam's cupboard. Yes. He and Teresa both took the Tylenol. And according to NBC 15 News, moments after they'd taken the Tylenol, they collapsed right there in the home.
Oh my gosh.
After being rushed to the hospital and life-saving measures being rendered to both of them, Stanley ended up passing away later that night, and Teresa wouldn't die until 2 days later when she was taken off life support.
Wow.
Now, at this point, police, paramedics, doctors descended on this home and they quarantined Kasia and her little brother, Tom, and their mother, Teresa, at the hospital. They didn't know what was going on with this family.
Right.
And this is, remember, Mary Kellerman's over here.
Right.
And this is a completely different suburb of Chicago. So they've got three people over here and they're thinking this is exclusive to this family.
Right. Okay.
At the time, it seemed like it could be concentrated to their home, maybe. Now, Adam's wife, Teresa, told CNN she remembered them hauling a bunch of stuff out of their house, like flowers and coffee grounds. Like, investigators were like, is this airborne or are they ingesting something? Like, what's going on? While all this chaos was going on over at the Janice home, over in Winfield, Illinois, just west of Chicago proper, Mary Lynn Rayner was about to feed her newborn baby. Her baby boy was only 6 days old, and she needed a Tylenol and probably wished she had something stronger.
Oh my gosh.
She took a capsule from her newly opened bottle, and moments later, she collapsed on the floor. She died the next morning, September 30th.
Oh my gosh.
Later that evening, around 6:45, Mary McFarlane was in the break room at the shopping mall where she worked. She needed some Tylenol to get through the last couple hours of her shift. We've all been there. A coworker was nearby when, just moments after Mary took those Tylenol, the 31-year-old single mother said, "I don't feel good," and just collapsed.
No way.
Like Mary Rayner, Mary McFarlane was dead by the next morning. Now, at 9:16 p.m., this is still the same day, guys, Paula Prince, a flight attendant, was headed home from the airport and was probably really looking forward to sleeping in her own bed.
Oh, yeah.
After a couple days on the road.
Yeah.
On the road, in the air. Nevertheless, she had stopped by a Walgreens to pick up some Tylenol, went home, took two before she went to bed. She wasn't found until 2 days later when her sister and friends stopped by to check on her.
Oh, no.
She was just 35 years old.
This makes me so sad.
Now, I'm not purposefully being vague about these last three victims. It's just that source material out there about mm-hmm. these three victims is pretty sparse. We likely only know about Paula. I mean, she was alone. She probably has had a receipt from Walgreens okay. for purchasing the Tylenol. And, you know, the other two, I'm not really sure why there's not more information. But it didn't take long for word to start circulating around the greater Chicago area that day, that night. There were a couple people that were actually instrumental in connecting the dots so early on in the investigation as to what was going on with these people. Mm-hmm. The day this all went down, off-duty fire lieutenant Phil Capitelli called his buddy Richard Keyworth, who was also a firefighter over in Elk Grove, where Mary Kellerman lived. Phil had heard about the 12-year-old's sudden death through his mother-in-law, who worked with Mary's mother at United Airlines.
Oh.
So.
Small world.
Yeah. You see, Mary's mother got the call when she was at work.
Okay.
About Mary being sick, and she just rushed out of there. So her coworkers were really worried.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what happened, you know?
Right.
Phil asked Richard, "My God, what happened to that little girl in Elk Grove?" And since HIPAA wasn't a thing back then, Richard was like, "Well, let me find out for you."
Yeah.
So he called up his station and he told Phil, you know, well, she took Tylenol and then she just died.
Mm.
So once Phil learned of this, he just thought, that poor family.
Yeah.
And now he's got to go tell his mother-in-law what happened to her coworker's daughter. I mean,
oof.
Now, it wasn't until that afternoon that Phil, who was an Arlington Heights firefighter, heard about Adam and his family dying after ingesting Tylenol, that things started connecting for him.
Right.
The Cook County ME's office held a press conference to explain how a child died after taking Tylenol, and then the same thing happened to six more people. And they cautioned the public about a potential poisoning or contamination in Tylenol. And a bigger, more horrifying picture began to emerge. I mean, it wasn't just a group of people. There was an accident. Something happened.
Right.
This was a public health crisis.
Oh, for
and
sure.
And everybody was at risk. I mean.
Yeah. Don't take Tylenol.
Right. And when I learned of this story as a kid, I remember thinking, how can that happen? Like, something that we just go grab off the shelf is supposed to, like, protect us. Now I don't trust it.
Right.
Like, now you can't trust.
Mm-hmm.
That's where my trust issues came from as a child, is this case. The Chicago Tribune reported that there were law enforcement officers going up and down the streets, like, right after things started connecting, and you can imagine the chaos of one department calling another department.
Oh, yeah.
And they were going up and down the streets with bullhorns going,
no way,
throw away your Tylenol. Like, did you just buy Tylenol? Like, standing outside of a store saying, ma'am, did you just buy some Tylenol? Throw it away. Or, you know, going into the store
or
and pulling
even
them off the shelves.
Yeah, having the management take Tylenol off the shelf. Yeah.
And to your point, thousands of calls were being made to retailers all over the Chicago area that might have sold, you know, Tylenol, convenience stores, you know, pharmacies, whoever, urging the workers
so
to pull
scary.
Them from the shelves immediately. Go get yourself a bag and get all the Tylenol off the shelves.
Yeah.
Now, during the investigation, law enforcement worked closely with healthcare experts to educate themselves on how to handle this situation appropriately. I mean, is it a touch thing or is like what's happening? Dr. Michael Petros was working for the Chicago Public Health Department when this outbreak occurred, and they wasted no time going to collect bottles of Tylenol from grocery stores, convenience stores, pharmacies themselves.
Oh.
Like, they went out themselves, boots on the ground, and they began to open each capsule, pour out the powder, looking for attributes of poison.
Huh.
I mean, they were fully suited up.
Whoa.
You know, ready to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And what do you know? Some of that white powder that they poured out of those capsules was not acetaminophen.
Really?
Which is the active ingredient in Tylenol, if you didn't know. It was actually potassium cyanide.
What?
Now they knew why all these people died so quickly.
Uh-huh.
It takes less than 0.4 grams to kill a 116-pound person.
What in the world?
And death will occur. Will occur within hours.
Oh, wow.
Likely before.
What and, kind of sicko?
Yeah. And by the way, let the record reflect that my search histories on my computer, how much cyanide is lethal, was only for the purposes of this episode. And side note, when you Google that, there's actually a lot of mental health helpline websites that come up first.
Wow.
Before you have to scroll down to how to poison someone. Just FYI.
Oh, okay.
Anyway, back to the story.
Does it actually tell you like how to? Oh my gosh.
Yeah, there's instructions out there. Good old internet. Now, McNeil Consumer Products manufactured Tylenol back in the 80s. And it's actually a subsidiary of the major brand Johnson & Johnson.
Mm.
Both companies cooperated with police in the early days of the investigation, issuing a recall of over 31 million bottles.
Oh, wow. Talk of the about popular loss.
I know. Well, I mean, they had no choice.
Right.
And they were going to lose a lot more than that if.
Oh,
if,
for sure.
You know, people were entitled to a replacement bottle, though I'm not sure they wanted one.
No, thank you.
And the public were notified that there would be a reward for anyone who could bring credible leads that would lead to an arrest. Johnson & Johnson did their own internal investigation into how these tainted capsules could have made it into the general population.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And they established that it couldn't have been done in their facility. It had to have been after the bottles reached the Chicago area retail stores.
Okay.
Now, on a basic level, let's just think about it as lay people. Mm-hmm. We don't work in a manufacturing plant. We don't know how it works. But I feel like each manufacturing plant doesn't just service one area, right? I mean,
right.
You have a massive Amazon facility right by my house.
Oh, yeah.
They probably deliver all across, you know, not just to my neighborhood.
Yeah.
So if the capsules were tampered with in the facility where they were made and bottled, there would have been cases of poisonings all around the country.
Right.
Or at least in a regional cluster right. of states. Right.
Yeah. But it's secluded to this.
Right.
One.
The city.
Yeah.
Yeah. But there was another discovery that made it glaringly obvious that someone in the manufacturing plant could not have been responsible. Some of the contaminated bottles came from different suppliers. Now, I can't speak to how it's done these days, but when I worked in the pharmacy between 2002 and 2008, McKesson was our supplier.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
So we had drug deliveries come every week. We were a small pharmacy, so we would sticker them and put them on the shelves. Now, McKesson got the drugs from the company.
Okay.
Whether over-the-counter or prescription. You can go online today and buy Tylenol from anywhere. China. Uzbekistan. I don't know. You can buy it from like Amazon or any online place and it will show up at your door. But Amazon and whatever retailer you're buying it from, they have a supplier.
Okay.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely.
So it's a chain of custody, if you will. Anywho, police now believe that someone went out, purchased the bottles of Tylenol, took them home, did some doctoring, took out all the acetaminophen of the gelatin capsules, and replaced it with cyanide. Then they took the contaminated bottles back to all random stores, just went around town depositing these and just put them front and center right there on the shelf to be purchased. In the early days of the investigation, Johnson & Johnson received a handwritten letter by snail mail.
Uh-huh.
They received it on October 5th from someone that said he was the killer. And he would stop the killings if he got $1 million.
Oh.
He included wiring information, like, send it here. The letter was only one page, but it did detail the logistics of how he could accomplish this heinous act.
Hmm.
it said, quote, "As you can see, it's easy to place cyanide, both potassium and sodium, in the capsules sitting in the store shelves. And since the cyanide is in the gelatin capsule, it is easy to get buyers to swallow the bitter pill. Another beauty is that the cyanide operates quickly. It takes so very little, and there will be no time to take countermeasures. So far, I have spent less than $50, and it takes me less than 10 minutes per bottle," end quote.
Wow. So, he is proud of himself.
Yeah.
Or she, I don't know, but what a sicko.
Right. According to Unsealed, the Tylenol Murders podcast, which I was able to listen to some of it, but it is a deep dive.
Oh.
I mean, I didn't have time to really listen to all of it. But I did get some really great nuggets from that podcast. So if you want a deep dive of this case, go listen to it.
Okay.
Something about this stood out to police because the poison in the bottles, the tainted bottles, was potassium cyanide, not sodium cyanide. Mm. Seems like if you were the killer, you would know that.
Okay.
And why would you mention sodium? You know what I mean? Like, if you were the killer, why would you mention sodium?
Right. If he used it in other bottles that weren't tested.
Right. But then there would have been more deaths.
Okay, true.
Then there were specifics about how much money he spent on this little endeavor. Yeah. And, like, how much time it took him to, you know, doctor each bottle.
So strange. Which seems
like something the person who did this would know. But authorities weren't going to write this off. They weren't, you know, they were going to hunt the sender down.
Okay.
The same day Johnson & Johnson received this letter, police got a tip from a local bartender that one of his regulars, Roger Arnold, had been acting really strange since the news of the Tylenol murders broke. And he had bragged about having cyanide at home.
Excuse me?
Yeah. Guess where Roger Arnold worked?
The pharmacy.
He worked at Jewel Grocery Store.
Oh.
Which was the same grocery store chain Adam Janis stopped by.
Yes.
To purchase his Tylenol, just in a different location. Same grocery store, different location.
Okay.
That would make anyone nervous. So police went to pick Roger up. You know, all this stuff is like, whoa. They also executed a search of Roger's apartment on October 11th, 1982, and found even more cause for concern.
Okay.
Books about explosives and poisonings, vials and beakers and test tubes.
What?
And a white powdery substance. They found a book called The Poor Man's James Bond, which detailed about how to make potassium cyanide.
Well, that does not look very good for this
guy. Doesn't look good at all. But his claim about having loads of cyanide at home, investigators didn't find any. I didn't see the report saying what that white powdery substance was, but I'm assuming it wasn't cyanide because they're saying they didn't find any in his apartment.
Mm-hmm.
Now, after hours of interrogation, they had no movement with Roger. He refused a polygraph. He maintained that he had nothing to do with the killings. They were sure that this was their guy. I mean, what are the odds that all of this would be in his apartment?
Right.
He was weird. He was unkempt, you know, and he'd recently had a divorce, which made him bitter and angry. So they just thought he looks good for it.
Right.
One other detail that was interesting. Roger's wife had recently spent time at Central DuPage Hospital, the same hospital that Mary Reiner had just given birth at.
Oh.
Mary Reiner purchased her tainted Tylenol bottle at the Frank's food store just across the street from the hospital.
Interesting.
But even with all of those interesting circumstantial instances, police didn't have enough to keep him. They didn't have enough to charge him.
Sounds like a lot, though.
They did have a lot of suspicious stuff, but it was nothing definitive. They didn't have, you know, anything directly linking him to it. So they had to release him.
Goodness.
Several months later, Roger Arnold killed a man.
What?
At the bar that he frequented, believing that this man was the one who turned him into police.
Whoa.
Because by this time, Roger Arnold's name was out there.
Oh, like, okay.
So he was being investigated. Searches were done on his house. The media was on this. His name was out there.
He wanted revenge.
And he was pissed.
Yeah.
But it wasn't the guy.
No.
He killed the wrong guy.
Oh, no.
Totally innocent man. He was sentenced to 30 years in prison for murdering someone.
Oh, my God.
And he died in 2008 after serving 15 years.
Wow.
But let's go back to the letter that Johnson & Johnson received.
Yeah, let's go back.
Well, while all this mess was going on with Roger Arnold and they're doing their investigation, they were following up with the letter, too. This is a mess, so just hold on to your butts.
Okay, I'm holding on.
They tracked the postage meter stamp from the envelope that the letter came in to a travel agency that turned out to be no longer in business.
Okay.
Before that company went under, a lady who worked there, Nancy Richardson, stamped a bunch of envelopes with the company postage meter as sort of like a stick it to the man, because the last paycheck she received from them for over $500 bounced. So she didn't get her last paycheck.
No. Oh,
So she's like, y'all owe me. So I'm taking some stamps, and she probably took some post-its and ballpoint pens as well.
That's a better revenge than killing somebody.
Back in the day, postage meters at small businesses or businesses, every law firm I've ever worked at had an assigned postage meter.
Oh, right.
That's so that, you know, at the end of the month, it's all tallied up and you pay what the postage was for that month. So you're not going and messing with stamps.
Uh-huh.
So children. If you don't know what a postage meter is, it's that. So they were able to track that postage meter to this travel agency. And that's how they got the Richardsons.
Okay.
So her husband, Robert Richardson, was pissed at how his wife had been treated through this whole thing. Could they have been the letter senders? What does this have to do with anything? Investigators found a poem submitted to the Chicago Tribune written by a Robert Richardson about life in Chicago. And below was his photo. They were like, what is this weirdness? Like, okay. So now they had his photo. And they used it for a wanted poster.
Wow.
They're like, we got to talk to you because... So the wanted posters were out, and it turns out that Robert and Nancy Richardson were aliases.
Oh.
Their names were really James and Leanne Lewis.
Why? It gets better.
According to a stipulation filed with the court October 27th, 1983, James and Leanne Lewis came to Chicago in 1981 from Kansas City, Missouri. It was there in Chicago that they started using the names Robert and Nancy. They lived and worked in Chicago until September 3rd, 1982. September 3rd, 1982.
Okay.
When they hightailed it to New York.
Oh.
Now, they told all their neighbors they were moving to Amarillo, Texas. Which, why would you move there?
That's completely opposite. Yeah, why would you?
Sorry, Amarillo. But they didn't. They moved to New York, so... Once we get more into these people, you'll realize like why they were being so weird.
Okay.
I'm going to refer to him as James Lewis moving forward because that's his name. So James Lewis was a career crook. He'd been involved in fraud schemes for so many years and had even been connected to a murder and dismemberment of an old man back in Kansas City. But he was never convicted for that.
Oh, good.
Yeah. He tried to kill his mother with an axe.
Oh.
And after that was sent to a state mental facility.
I would say he probably needs to be there.
Yes. But no charges were filed for that.
Okay.
And with all of this, the letter, the history of violence and fraud, James Lewis became a prime suspect in the Tylenol murder case.
As he should be.
But even With all of this, police said they couldn't tie him to the Chicago area at the time of the murders. Remember, he left Chicago September 3rd. And everyone was poisoned September 29th.
Okay.
If he had left them on the shelves before he left, the murders would have, like, people would have died much sooner. You know what I mean? Like, these people.
Unless he put it in the back of the things to give him enough time. He put it behind all of the stuff so that he could have time to get away and be away.
But. That's a good point. No. Like, I like your thinking because that would be, that would have been a strategy that he might have done. However, everyone died on the same day. So everybody bought that bottle the day before.
Okay.
So it seems like
in different places.
They were in different places. So it seems like those bottles were deposited on the 28th.
Okay.
That's what it feels like to me.
Yeah. That does make sense.
Except Adam bought his that day.
Okay. Right.
Mary's mother, the 12-year-old, bought that the night before.
Hmm.
Paula bought hers the day of. So it's tough. I mean, maybe he did it over 2 days. I think they were hoping to find like a bus or airfare ticket or something to put him back in Chicago.
Yeah.
Doing the deed. But he and his wife were using aliases. I mean, and back in the 80s, you could travel under a different name. You could just say, hey, my name is Joe Schmo. And, you know, it wasn't so like strange. It is today where you're showing your ID and everything's verified and blah, blah, blah. Now, the only thing they could really charge him with was the extortion on Johnson & Johnson. And he ended up being convicted for that.
Interesting.
James further painted a target on his back when he made an interesting move after being convicted for the extortion charge. He calls up the FBI.
Oh, gosh.
This is after he's convicted. What? Okay. He's in jail. He told them, I can help you find the real killer.
Okay.
You know, come to think of it, I think I can help with this.
Okay. Because it takes a sick and twisted mind to help find a sick and twisted mind. Mm-hmm. Okay.
So the FBI were like, all right, go on. And they interviewed him multiple times to gain his expertise in criminology, apparently. Now, James went to prison for that extortion charge, but he was never charged with the murders. You know, in these interviews that he gave with FBI, he was talking about how someone might go about doing this. They might take these bottles. They might pull some tainted capsules out of their pocket and put them in the bottle and put them back on the shelf. He also drew diagrams of how somebody would fill capsules.
Oh.
What's it called? The bread method or something. It's been a long time since I worked in the pharmacy, but when I worked in the pharmacy, I used to do compounding.
Uh-huh.
And I would have to crush up different medicines that were tablets, and I would have to make capsules out of them.
Okay.
So I know the diagram that he drew, I know that machine.
Okay.
It's not a machine, it's a tool.
Okay, gotcha.
It's like this big square thing with little holes so you can put all the little capsules, empty capsules in.
That makes sense.
Then you pour out the powder on the top and spread it around so that all the powder falls in.
Okay.
And it's evenly distributed in the capsule. Then you put the lids on the top of the capsule.
Okay. So he knew how to do all this.
So he's drawing a diagram saying maybe they did it this way. But his drawings, and I'll try to post some on CBS had a really great treasure trove of like case files and like his diagrams and drawings. So I'll try to post some on our Patreon. Join Patreon. So anyway, it's like, why go through all the detail if you didn't have anything to do with it.
He was just having some kind of fun.
Yeah. I mean,
so strange.
He did serve time for that extortion charge. They had no fingerprints. Yeah. They had no, you know, nothing
to prove.
Yeah. And also in these interviews, James willingly talked to police without an attorney.
Oh.
I mean, he had his confident pants on.
Yeah. He opened it up for himself.
Yes, exactly. James Lewis maintained that he was not involved in the Tylenol murders until the end. But when he got out of prison on that extortion charge, he was charged with rape and kidnapping in 2004, but those charges were dropped.
I am so sick of hearing that sentence.
Mm-hmm. In 2009, the FBI did another search of his home. By now, he was living in Cambridge, Massachusetts. But nothing came of that either. They even re-interviewed him in 2022, but nothing came of that either. There was renewed interest in 2022 because it was the 40-year anniversary.
Mm.
And police were really trying to, like, make a happy 40th anniversary, we caught him type of thing.
Okay.
So they were putting together, you know, additional information. James Lewis's daughter was 5 when she died.
Oh.
She actually had Down syndrome and a congenital heart defect, and she had heart surgery. And the sutures that they used for her heart surgery broke, essentially. Without a better word, they broke. And that's how she died.
Oh.
The sutures were manufactured by Johnson & Johnson.
Okay.
A subsidiary of Johnson & Johnson, but nevertheless.
Right.
Now, they couldn't use this as a motive because they weren't sure this happened before the murders back in 1982.
It seems
like you could know that.
Yes.
Okay.
That's confusing.
Seems like you could know that. But even with all of the new, and they actually put a new PowerPoint together for the district attorney's office and prosecutors to consider.
Mm-hmm.
They would not go forward with it.
Why? What? Why?
They were like, please, please, let's charge him and let's try it. It's been 40 years. It's gonna be too late at some point. You know, we've got to shoot our shot.
Yeah.
With the jury.
Yeah.
But it was too late. James Lewis died last year in 2023 in his home in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Aww. And by now it's been over 40 years since someone terrorized the Chicago area and took something that was meant to help the public and used it as a weapon.
Yeah, that's so sick.
No new information has been brought to the table. And like I said at the top of the episode, police still consider this to be open and active, though they are pretty sure that the killer died.
Yeah. Seems like it.
If your head is spinning and you need more, go listen to Unsealed, the Tylenol Murders podcast. It's like an 8-episode, I think there's 8 episodes. It's a deep dive, like I said.
Okay.
Deep dive if you really want to get nitty gritty about it.
Huh.
But that, I tried to put it as concise as possible. They even looked at Ted Kaczynski for this crime, the Unabomber.
Really?
Yeah. They were trying to link his DNA to the bottles and...
They were grasping at straws.
They were like... I mean, he's got it out for the public.
Well, true.
I mean, that went nowhere, of course. But
that just makes my stomach turn to know that you're just living your life. You're going to go get something that's going to help you feel better. And it does quite the opposite.
Here's a funny story. Let me just end it on a funny note.
Okay.
Let's talk about tamper seals.
Okay.
There was a time in my life where I was throwing away countless bottles of chicken broth, like cartons of chicken broth.
Okay.
Because when I opened
Yeah. it breaks the seal.
I was breaking the seal.
Uh-huh.
But I thought the seal was broken.
Oh, no.
So I was throwing them away. Like, I threw away five things of it before I was smart enough to realize that I, the Hulk, was breaking the seals in one swift movement.
Uh-huh.
And that it was me. It was me who was doing it.
Yeah.
So,
Hey, you can't be too safe.
Listen to me when I say I don't trust anyone. If something is weird, if a seal is broken, I mean, half the seals you can hardly even get into. You have to get a knife and like the children's vitamins that I buy.
Yeah.
You can't peel that off. You got to go get a knife and cut into that thing. Plus, you've got multiple safeguards now. You've got the lids that you have to squeeze and open.
Yes.
Then you have the seals. Then you have the cotton.
Yeah.
So it's like that all occurred in 1983, the year after this case.
Okay.
And
that was fast.
Peanut butter started getting sealed.
Uh-huh.
Other foods started getting sealed. Pringles probably weren't sealed. You know, if you think about all the things that that make us feel safe.
That's, wow.
It's just, it's wild. So.
So many emotions, so many thoughts.
I know. It's terrible.
So sad.
It's so, so sad.
But yes, thank goodness we've got that precaution, that safeguard now. Ooh, that's neat though that it's, you know, this case is kind of a precedence case of.
It is.
Yeah.
Yeah, it really is.
How it started, the sealing.
Can you imagine Kasha losing her dad and her aunt and uncle all in one day from this? I mean,
that's unbelievable. It really like,
and being gathering there, like mourning the loss of Adam and then they drop dead. Like it's just
the odds that you pick up that bottle of Tylenol, the odds that your family come over and they're like, oh, I need some Tylenol. Like what?
I know.
Oh, if you could just be, it's like you're watching a movie and you just want to be like, don't do it. Don't take it.
I know. It's really tough. Now, I'm an NSAID head, so I prefer an ibuprofen or an naproxen. But Tylenol is the leading pain reliever. I mean, people reach for the Tylenol. You have a backache, you have a headache.
Yeah, just make sure it's sealed before you take it, guys. That's sealed. That's your disclaimer here. So,
yeah.
Oof. Mm-hmm. Well, that was great. Thank you for telling their story. That was great. Let's do it again sometime.
Let's do it. We'll see you next week, guys.
Bye.
Bye now. Thank you for listening to Cousins on Crime. If you're enjoying our podcast, please consider leaving us a positive review and rating. To make sure you never miss an episode, subscribe to our show.
You can also follow us on Instagram at Cousins on Crime Podcast. Or send case suggestions to cousinsoncrime@gmail.com.